one of my favorite pieces. That is by Randy Weston, a disciple of Thelonious Monk and a master jazz pianist, composer, and arranger in his own right. This is from his 1993 collaborative effort with arranger Melba Liston. If you know Melba Liston, you know that she's one of the first women jazz artists on the scene, and noted for her skills on the trombone. This is from the album Volcano Blues, and it's got a roster of extraordinary musicians, too numerous to mention. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. And a couple of things. I'm back. I had a little setback there for a minute. I was hospitalized, and not having to do with cancer, but having to do with kidney stones. And I had not ever experienced that kind of pain in my life. I tell you, I wanted Dilaudid and morphine and all kinds of opiates. I wanted industrial strength because it was just so bad. But anyway, I managed to come through. So I did miss our date yesterday. I missed our date to continue our discussion, which we'll do today. But let me talk first about our president's bizarre ways of doing things that continue to confound. President Trump yesterday pulled a fast one that left many U.S. lawmakers and foreign trade officials deeply puzzled. You think? According to reports, a hastily called news conference in the Rose Garden, this is now by Trump himself, to announce an agreement with the European Union on tariffs, the trouble, of course, was no one seemed to know that there was any such thing. Let me share this report with you. It's headlined, Republicans Visiting White House Surprised by EU, that's the European Union, Trade Announcement. Lawmakers who went to the White House for a meeting to discuss trade Wednesday were pulled into the drama of his surprise announcement of an agreement with Europe on tariffs. Senators who spoke with ABC News after the meeting said they had no idea they were about to walk into a Rose Garden announcement on tariffs for the European Union, but they welcomed the news, saying they hoped it would lead to additional deals with other countries locked in a trade war with the United States. Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, he's a Republican, said the last-minute stagecraft in which President Donald Trump announced an agreement in principle on trade, along with European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, was taking shape, even as the Republican House and Senate members were arriving at the White House. The announcement that they were supposed to be a part of, which they didn't know they were supposed to be a part of, except that they were supposed to come to witness something, some kind of announcement, and then they arrive only to learn on the spot that there is going to be an announcement, and that they, they're now assembled. Trump organized it in such a way as if this is how it was organized all along. Quote, the word that we got from staff was, it was coming together. Trump was saying, okay, what's the next meeting? And they said, Mr. President, the next meeting is with senators and House members. And he said, well, just bring them on out to hear this because they'll want to hear it. So we literally stepped outside to the colonnade area to be able to hear it. At the same time, a lot of the staff were hearing it because it had just been inked inside. In other words, this was completely on the spot, an arrangement made by Trump on the spot. The announcement was made on the spot, and he's making it look like this was well organized to impress the folks from the European Union. Quote, we arrived there, and then we became eye candy. This is what the chairman of the Agricultural Committee, Pat Roberts, is saying of the senators joining this event. They became eye candy. They had no idea what was going on. They were not told that the president was making any announcement. They were told that they were to have a meeting with him to discuss trade. And they walk into this thing, whatever it was, the president is casting it as an announcement and a formal announcement, as if it is the result of very careful thinking and discussion. The lawmakers were preparing to warn the president of the consequences of his ongoing aggression on trade. So they were coming to the White House to have a sit down with President Trump to basically warn him that he's doing the wrong thing on trade. They had no idea that there was this other thing that the president was doing. And suddenly they walked into a setup where the president is now presenting them, because they're now part of the announcement, presenting his sudden announcement on trade with the European Union. Many of them from farm states were also planning to relay messages from their constituents about how they would prefer markets be reopened than rely on additional government aid, as the White House had recently suggested, with an offer of $12 billion for farmers affected by tariffs. So they're coming in to kind of read the riot act to the president, because among other things, the president has decided that unilaterally he would suspend, or he would simply not recognize or cancel outright, longstanding trade agreements, because of course he has to show he's a tough guy. He has to show the world and certainly Americans. But as we learned today too, American farmers are gearing up to let him have it on this matter of trade, because now the farming community is hurting. And Trump is being cornered, and this is how he's behaving. So what he decided to do to just kind of smooth things over is he came up with this plan to float $12 billion in kind of farm aid, welfare for farmers, and they don't want that. They want trade. They want the arrangements that had been in play that the president unilaterally canceled. And now, as a kind of political gesture, he's saying, well, look, I'm setting aside $12 billion to help tide you guys over, but they are not going for this at all. And this was a very important part of the president's constituency. The farming community and the farming constituency, they are up in arms, and they're getting ready to organize a major campaign against him. But the interesting thing here is that, you know, Trump is again displaying all the signs of somebody whose mind is shot. He's doing all kinds of crazy things. And people are choosing to interpret it simply as, you know, a series of political moves that he's making. No, the man's mind is shot. He's caving in under the pressure. And he is likely to do even more erratic things. So we had yesterday a glaring example of Trump's mental illness or illnesses. He tells nobody about anything. He just comes up with this thing out of thin air. This is how he's making policy for this nation. And it seems to be okay, because nobody is really having any big quarrels with Donald Trump with the way he's running things. We're not hearing that there are problems with the president and the way he is conducting business. We're not hearing complaints about this kind of slipshod way. This is crazy. Well, it happened that it was about trade, but it could have been something really serious. He could have been this flippant about something involving, you know, military action or something really, really serious that could have had not just domestic impact, but global impact. And he made the decision all by himself. And people refuse, they just refuse to say, it's time to call the president's mental acuity into question. Never mind all the stuff about, well, who, what he's doing and who disagrees and whatnot. The fact is, this kind of behavior, this way of operating, is not only bizarre, it is scary. And it ought to signal to responsible people who are calling themselves lawmakers, people in the Senate, people in the House, and even people in the profession, people who have some kind of standing, to bring to the attention of the country that we cannot entrust the fate of the country to Donald Trump. He's running a one-man show. He's doing whatever it is he wants to do. He has defied everybody. He's not accountable to anybody. He's not accounting to anybody. He doesn't feel that he needs to consult with anybody having to do with representing the interests of the people. That's not what he thinks. He thinks he's running a subsidiary of Trump Inc. And if we thought that he was shaky before, if we thought that he was prone to act in a kind of you know, all of a sudden he comes up with an idea, and it's because he comes up with the idea, it's a great idea. That's not how it's done. But we're going into the second year of his tenure, and we can see how much damage has been done, and we can also see how people have just been immobilized by it, refusing to call it as we see it. This president has some major mental problems. It is going to cost us dearly, and maybe not just us. So something has to be done to call this, to reel him in, or to put some kind of a barrier between him and these kinds of reckless decisions that would have enormous impact and lasting impact. I've been saying for a long time that the president's mental acuity, his mental health, clearly is in question here. But it doesn't seem to bother anybody in Congress. They're discussing politics as if all things are, you know, the usual. And there's this push and pull that we expect between the president and Congress and all this other kind of stuff. But no, we have a very fundamental problem, and it's a scary one, because at any time we should expect this president to do something that is irreversible and catastrophic. The legislators yesterday and the representatives from the European Union had no idea, no idea at all, that this was what the president in his spare time in the afternoon had produced, and they walk into something that they had no input in. They had no time at all to contribute to it. And this is now real. He has signed something that he just made up out of his mind probably 10 minutes before, because the report says that even as they were assembling, he was putting the finishing touches on this thing. Okay, so now tell me I'm crazy. We'll take a break and come back to the second half of our program. We'll talk about two systems of justice when we do. Alternative system of justice, a two-tiered system. We began talking about it, but then in the middle of all this, I ended up having to go to the hospital. We began talking about the case of Eric Garner, who was killed, murdered, they're thinking of telling us over and over again, it was just one police officer who did it. Officer Daniel Pantaleo. But in fact, we saw the tape. It was a pack of police officers. And they were assisting Daniel Pantaleo in taking down, or in taking down meaning in doing the arrest of Eric Garner. And the charge was to be that Eric Garner was selling what they call loosies, or loose cigarettes that came from untaxed packs of cigarettes. We saw on the tape, we saw him apply a chokehold, and that he maintained the chokehold until he brought Eric Garner down. Eric Garner said 11 times, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe." But he maintained the chokehold until Eric Garner was dead. Now, that's 4 years ago, and supposedly he's to come to trial soon, but it's not a trial. And this is where we have to get involved. This is not a trial. This is a departmental hearing. So immediately the signal that we are being sent is this police officer who without question killed a civilian, for lack of a better term, using a maneuver that was outlawed by the department itself. The department had outlawed the use of chokeholds. They prohibited it back in OG. I'll find it in my notes in a minute. But it was prohibited. It was found to be unconstitutional. It was found to be against police practices. And it was outlawed. It was banned. So right away, we have some interesting things to consider. That entire pack of police officers is not coming to trial. Only one of them is. Pantaleo. And it has taken 4 years to decide that he ought to face some kind of charges, but not a trial, but a hearing. So immediately, the prosecution of the police officer who killed a person using an outlawed method of subduing arrestees, he's afforded a different kind of justice altogether. He's not going through the regular court. He will not be tried by a jury of his peers. The people won't ever see him being questioned and listen to the answers that he gives. He is going through a hearing, which automatically also means when you go through a hearing, hearings don't produce convictions and jail time. So there's no expectation of that. He's just going to have a hearing. And this is now putting the case, the prosecution, if you will, of an errant police officer, taking it outside of the system where it properly belongs, and that's a criminal justice system. He's to be regarded as a criminal like any other criminal. But he is going to be now brought before, he's going to be brought into a friendly environment, a more friendly environment. Because the people asking him questions and the people seeking to understand what happened are people who, like him, are on the force. This now gives, and this should concern us, this now transfers the power and authority of prosecution to the police department. And that is a major problem. He's being tried by his own. How is it that the police chief ends up with all this power and authority to decide ultimately what happens to Pantaleo? How is it that the power of the state is arrogated to him? When, if it were any regular person, everybody would understand and expect it to go through the courts, the court system, the jury system, the prison system. But because he's a police officer, and although he has killed a person, or has been connected with the death of a person using illegal means, nonetheless, he gets a whole different system of justice. And he gets 4 years. And that same system has made no plan to try any of the other officers who helped him apply that chokehold and who helped him in the arrest, so-called arrest of Eric Garner that killed him. So we have already been fooled into thinking, well, it took a while, but the wheels of justice are turning. You'd be crazy if you think that. It's your stomach that's turning. And we ought to bring this question right out in the open. Bring it to the fore. This is a form of corruption. This is a form of injustice. When police officers, even when they clearly have played a role in the killing of a person, still can count on a sympathetic hearing, separate and apart from the system that would normally try such crimes. How is it that this does not sound unusual and wrong to the likes of the mayor of the city of New York or the police commissioner of the city of New York or the members of the city council. I've said many, many times, the city council has power, which they refuse to exercise. They can actually fire the police commissioner. They could fire the mayor. They have the right to call hearings, open hearings. They allocate the funds for the police department. And they have a right to call the department to account for its practices. But there is not any objection to the police department, in effect, investigating itself. And we know how this is going to go. We know how this is going to turn out. What I'm bringing to your attention here is that right before our eyes, and we're no exception, this is what happens across the country. This is what the Justice Department was supposed to correct. This is what the Justice Department was supposed to investigate. How is it that police officers, criminal police officers, are given the advantage of a system that does not in any way function the way it would function if the person being, quote, charged, unquote, was appearing in a regular court? It took the police department a long enough time to even question Pantaleo or any of the officers. I've talked about the 48-hour rule in New York City and in other places, that a prosecutor even may not question a police officer about anything for 48 hours or two working days, whichever works to his or her advantage, in cases even that involve the deaths, the shooting deaths, or the killings of individuals. That is considered part of his union benefits. In the real world where we exist, you don't get to tell the prosecutor, I'm not talking to you until next Wednesday at 7 o'clock. You don't get to order your justice. You don't get to, you know, put your thing together the way you want it. But this is routine. How long did it take between the time that Eric Garner was killed and when Daniel Pantaleo and all those officers were questioned? How long? It wasn't an instant thing. I guarantee you that. And if, in fact, all of the officers that we saw in that tape were questioned, well, what became of that inquiry? I remember on the day that Pantaleo was to be questioned down at police headquarters, there were so many safeguards about what he could be asked and what he could not be asked, according to union rules, as if murder is a union matter. But as a police officer, it comes with part of their collective bargaining. What cops, the rights of cops have that exceed or supersede the rights that anybody else has in matters like this. Why is that allowed? And it's the same all over the country. In all these cases where police officers clearly are responsible for the deaths of citizens, no prosecutor could just go in there and arrest them and take them in for questioning. Can't happen. Most of them are protected by union contracts. 48 hours or 2 working days, whichever works to his or her advantage. So this hearing is not a trial, which is another benefit he yields, Pantaleo, which is coming up soon. This is the time that members of the city council, the whole city council, ought to raise this question, since the mayor is not brave enough to do so. But the whole city council can do something immediate, with immediate impact, and that is to shut down the budget until somebody gives us some answers here about who is in charge here. Demand to know from the mayor why he allows a two-tiered system of justice. Demand to know how it is that the police commissioner is also a judge. Whose decisions are binding? There are lots of questions to be asked here. Now, I need to mention, and I just can't ignore, what we've been talking about in terms of how lawyers and others deal with these matters when ostensibly they are representing the interests of the people in cases involving police brutality or police killings and so forth, police violence. You would notice the lawyers are not present. They're not standing next to Mrs. Carr, the mother of Eric Garner, as she pleads for justice. I told you before, there's a big difference between settlement and justice. A settlement is not justice. All who were supposed to get paid have gotten paid. And now, reality has hit really hard. Mrs. Carr, and perhaps one or two members of her family, have finally realized there is no justice. And now she wants justice. Settlements are not justice. In fact, when you agree to a settlement, you agree, in effect, to forfeit justice, because a settlement is justice, as far as the city is concerned. You may have it in your head that it isn't, but I tell you, from the point of view of the city, you got your justice. We gave you $5.6 or $5.9 million. That's justice. Now what is your problem? The lawyers who were there urging justice, and I did point out that I hadn't seen a single piece of paper that convinced me that justice was the number one priority. And how did I become convinced of that? Nobody, none of her legal advisors, filed papers demanding the appointment of a special prosecutor. It was the same in Ferguson. It's the same in almost all these cases. They're not interested in fighting for justice. They want large crowds in the street. They want a lot of noise. And they want the picture of an outraged community. But justice requires some hard work. When Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, I said the same thing. There is not a single piece of paper, legal paper, that says we demand the appointment of a special prosecutor. Now, other people may have come up with that idea and may even have pursued it. But I'm talking about the legal advisors who ought to know better. And why is that important? Because it's your signal that you want justice, not money. Now, the law does provide for compensation, financial compensation, to any aggrieved family that has lost a loved one to police murder and police violence. It provides that. But you can't tell me that's your only concern. And once you get that settlement, you're done. Justice has been done. So we're finding out in a very embarrassing way what we knew from the start. Settlements are not justice. And if you confuse the two, then that's what you will get. In fact, as I had discussed before, the terms of settlement require you to forego justice. The terms of settlement require you to accept payment as justice. You will not hold the city or the police officer as an agent of the city liable for anything done to your loved one. You agree to that. You have to sign papers saying that. You will not accuse the city or any of its agents of doing wrong. You're not going to do that. You have to sign to that. You have to agree to that. You will never sue the city ever in life again over the matter that is distressing you the most, which is the death of your loved one. You can't do that. You have to agree to that. You have to sign papers for that. So you see, we come back to square one. None of the big time actors are around now to instruct what to do. They're not around now demanding no justice, no peace, and all of that other stuff. By the way, I originated that that saying. I wrote an editorial saying, don't ask us for peace if you're not prepared to discuss justice. No justice, no peace. Next thing you know, it's the cry at protests. But I meant it. It was not a slogan. I meant it that that should be the attitude. So here we have, we are anticipating this disciplinary hearing. It's not a trial, even. A disciplinary hearing. Police officers can have disciplinary hearings when they killed somebody. They can have departmental hearings outside of the court when they kill somebody. They're not being tried by a jury. And the police commissioner is the one who will make the final decision. Now you tell me that that is a free and fair system, and we should be okay with that. I'm saying these things happen for a reason. We get reminded all the time of the ways in which we have just abrogated our responsibility to the next generation and the generation after that. We just walk away and we still continue to hold on or to try to persuade people that we are activists and we are interested in justice. You're not interested in justice. Nothing has changed. Eric Garner died 4 years ago. And not one thing procedurally or departmentally or legally has changed. Not one thing. Nor has anything changed in the way people go about, as I call them, the collectors of bones. They rush to the scene of a homicide by police, make a big fuss, get people out in the street, in the sun, screaming at empty office buildings, people running around buying new sneakers. Because in their heads, they're contributing to a struggle. No struggle. This is when we should hear from them and the apparatus that says that they are about civil rights. This is when we should hear from them. This is when we should expect them to engage in full-scale battle in the courts. There should be a torrent of lawsuits challenging the authority of the police department to hear itself and to fix itself and to appoint the chief as a judge. And to demand answers as to why it took 4 years. And even so, only one police officer is being charged. Well, he's not even being charged. Let's be accurate here. He's not being charged. This is a hearing. The purpose of the hearing is to find out how far off from recommended conduct was he when he killed Eric Garner. He has not been charged. And we have to ask questions about how this continues. Anywhere you go in the United States, you'll find a version of this. Especially in big cities. So, I'm saying that we are reminded of these things for a reason. We are reminded of these things to examine the contradictions that we have to deal with all the time in this thing called civil rights struggle. We are reminded of the people who are prepared to go the long haul and people who are just blowhards. But most of all, we are reminded that we abrogate our commitment and our duty to the Eric Garners of the world, who should rest in peace, knowing that we are still fighting for them, so that we could prevent any other Eric Garners. But we are falling short. We have no excuse. But we can at least commit to making sure that this process be exposed and become a central question before the New York City Council and the state legislature and all state legislatures across the country. Thanks so much for listening. I really appreciate the fact that you allowed me the time to stretch out a little bit here today. And we'll come back to each other tomorrow. Free Your Mind Friday is on the menu. Bye-bye. Thank you.